Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Here's the White House position on Roy Moore and the Washington Post article about Moore dating 14 to 18-year-olds when he was in his 30s, including the woman who says Moore had her take off her clothes and touch his genitals when she was 14. This is the White House position as of now.
There's no Senate seat more important than the notion of child pedophilia, Chuck. I mean, that's the reality. But having said that, he has not been proven guilty of that, and we have to afford him the chance to defend himself.
That was the White House legislative director, Mark Short, on Meet the Press yesterday. Funny thing is, Moore already did defend himself on the Sean Hannity radio show on Friday, and he didn't quite deny a lot of what's in the Post story. He did deny the encounter with the 14-year-old, but on the 16, 17, and 18-year-olds, when he was 32 and 34, this clip starts with a Hannity question.
At that time in your life, let me ask you this. You do remember these girls. Would it be unusual for you as a 32-year-old guy to have dated a woman as young as 17? That would be a, 15-year difference, or a girl 18. Do you remember dating girls that young at that time?
Not generally, no. If I did, I'm not going to dispute anything, but I don't remember anything like that.
But you don't specifically remember having any girlfriend that was in her late teens even at that time?
I don't remember that, and I don't remember ever dating any girl without the permission of her mother. And I think in her statement, she said that her mother actually encouraged her to go out with me.
So Moore says he didn't generally go out with 17 and 18-year-olds, and he said, I'm not going to dispute anything. That was in the clip. And he said he didn't remember dating any girl without the permission of her mother. And sure enough, in the Washington Post story, it says two of the mothers of the teenagers approved of their relationships at the time. One, whose daughter was 18 when Moore was 32, said she let her go out with him because she thought he'd be good husband material for her daughter. Another, who dated Moore when she was 17 and Moore was 34, told the Post that her mother said she was, quote, the luckiest girl in the world, because Moore was such a respected figure in the community at the time. But Moore, on Hannity, by affirming that story, acknowledged that he pursued teenage girls when he was in his 30s. The questions now are, is that disqualifying, even if their mothers approved at the time? And who will the voters in the Republican Party believe in the other case, Moore or the then 14-year-old Lee Korfman, who is now 53? Republican Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania has made his decision.
We'll probably never know for sure exactly what happened. But from my point of view, I have to say, I think the accusations have more credibility than the denial. I think it would be best if Roy would just step aside.
Pat Toomey on Meet the Press. Most Republican senators, however, are still taking the White House position. They want more proof. And in a country in which most white voters discounted the Access Hollywood tape enough to vote for Trump, what Alabamans will do on Election Day, December 12th, certainly remains to be seen. On that and other Monday morning politics, we welcome David Graham, politics writer for The Atlantic. Hi, David. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning.
How many Pat Toomeys are there as of now compared to how many Donald Trumps?
the weight of a Pat Toomey, I think, is significantly less than a Donald Trump, so that makes a difference. But you do see a growing number of senators who seem to be taking this stance that it doesn't matter whether there's a court of law judgment. What matters is the allegations themselves.
I don't think it's a majority of Republicans in the Senate yet, or a majority in the Alabama legislature. Do you, from what you can tell?
No, I don't believe so.
So to the White House and the majority Republican position, can any more proof emerge, or is this basically going to come down to who Republicans believe based on how well-sourced the Post story is? They've got 30 sources and corroborating witnesses like friends and parents who said they were told at the time.
Yeah, I think that's a great question, is what is the amount of evidence that these folks would accept? I do think the idea that, he has a chance to defend himself is one thing, but the idea that he hasn't been convicted or something doesn't, political sins are different from legal sins. And this may be both, but I'm not sure why we have to wait for a conviction. I understand why the Trump people are a little bit nervous about this for the obvious reasons of the allegations against him. But it would be nice to see people explain what it is, what evidence, you know, standard of evidence would actually make them accept these stories. Would it be other women who are 14 who had similar experiences? Would it be a videotape? I mean, it seems like the standard is unreasonably high.
And Mitt Romney, we should point out, did make exactly the distinction that you made a second ago, that the standard here in a Senate race should not be the same as in a court of law, where the person is being tried for an alleged crime, innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. The standard here is in his behavior, even if it was legal, and who's credible. So Romney has staked out his position that he believes the women. Moore, though, is in one breath denying everything, and in the next saying what he said there on Hannity. I didn't generally, and their mothers gave me permission anyway, and I'm not going to dispute anything. Where does that leave his credibility, and why are so many Republicans seeming to ignore those contradictions?
Yeah, I mean, you've got those statements from Moore where he basically confirms that he did this sort of thing. You have a former colleague of his in the district attorney's office who said it was common knowledge that he was dating teenagers. So, you know, there's a lot that confirms everything except for this, the story from Lee Korfman, which makes Korfman's story seem a lot more credible. I think the reason people are not accepting it, Republicans are not accepting it, is fairly simple partisanship. This is an important Senate seat. They don't want to lose it. And so from one angle, there's sort of motivated reasoning to back Moore, no matter what he says. I think the other question is a sort of information polarization. Because this story comes from the Washington Post, there are a lot of people who immediately dismiss it just simply for that reason. And they assume that there's some sort of vendetta going on, and so they dismiss it and will buy whatever Moore says, no matter what the evidence is.
One of the weirdest and maybe most offensive pieces of this whole story is that Roy Moore immediately began fundraising off these allegations when the Washington Post published them on Thursday. I guess that's an example of the information polarization you were just mentioning. Did you see that?
I did see that. And, you know, that's unsavory, but it is probably from a pure strategic level smart. I bet that's an effective fundraising tactic.
We got a tweet just now from a listener who says, my father was 15 years older than my mother. The marriage lasted 40 years until he died. And I wonder if you want to tweet us again how old your parents were at the time. And those defending Moore say if he did everything in the story, even if he did everything in the story, it was 40 years ago, and he went on to get married in the 1980s and is still married to the same woman to this day. And then there are the truly horrible defenders among Alabama Republicans, one of whom compared Moore, if he did it, to Joseph from the Bible, who married Mary when she was a teenager, and another state legislator, Ed Henry, who said of Moore's victims, quote, if they believe this man is predatory, they are guilty of allowing him to exist for 40 years. I think someone should prosecute and go after them, unquote. Now, you're in Washington, but any idea of how much of an outlier or not that state lawmaker is in Alabama?
There are a lot of people making statements along these lines. I think he is perhaps further along than other people. But you do see people making these defenses, and you pointed a second ago to the crucial distinction. It's not just the age gap. I mean, it's the question that this woman was 14. It's that the age of consent in Alabama is 16. I think that they are outliers, but I'm not sure how much of outliers they are. And it's hard to tell in the absence of really strong polling. Not a lot of great state level polling in general, so we don't have a good sense of exactly where the electorate is in Alabama.
And despite how well corroborated, well reported this story seems to be, Moore now says he will sue the Washington Post. That seems to be new this morning or as of last night. Do you know the grounds?
Well, he's going to claim defamation. It's hard to believe that this would go very far, but I think it's a way for him to sort of, in the short, you know, we're not going to get a trial before the election, obviously, and it's a way for him to claim he's putting his money where his mouth is to defend himself, I think.
My guest is David Graham, The Atlantic political correspondent, as we talk about various Monday morning politics. Our phone number, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And another thing happening today is jockeying over the tax bill. You wrote an article that said any suggestion that the Republicans' base is clamoring for the bill appears to conflate the demands of GOP donors with those of rank-and-file GOP voters. And sure enough, here's Trump's top economics advisor, Gary Cohn, on NBC on Thursday. Listen up. This is just 3 seconds, folks.
The most excited group out there are big CEOs about our tax plan.
The most excited group out there are big CEOs about our tax plan. David, can you put that into context for us?
You can tell Gary Cohn is a less experienced politician because he has an unfortunate habit of speaking honestly. And I think that's an example of that. This is true. You just don't see a whole lot of support among rank and file for this tax plan. And it's interesting. We saw Trump run as a populist, and now we see him pushing a tax plan that heavily advantages the wealthy. That's, of course, not unusual for Republican tax plans, which have tended to argue for a sort of trickle-down concept. But it's interesting to see even the Trump administration doing this. But the fact that it won't help most people that much is reflected, I think, in the polling. People aren't that excited about seeing large tax cuts for corporations and the wealthy.
And you had a similar quote to the Gary Cohn one there from New York Republican Congressman Chris Collins from upstate New York, a big Trump supporter. He said, "My donors are saying get this done or don't ever call me again." Is it significant that he said his donors, not his constituents?
I think it is. And you know, Collins is an interesting case because he's in New York, where the state and local tax deduction is such a big deal. You see this from representatives in New Jersey as well. People understand that they could be really hit hard in their districts if they approve this plan. And so they're being crunched between the people they need to get reelected and the people they need to fund those reelections. And the winners, I think, will depend on how strong their donors are and how strong the pressure from leadership is.
You took a position in that article that's the opposite of what most of the media is saying, that the tax bill's fate will not sink or float Republican control of Congress in 2018. The conventional wisdom, including, I think, from Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, maybe even Trump and Bannon, is that it will, that Republican-leaning voters need to see at least one major GOP priority bill from Congress in the Trump era, and so far there are zero. What's your argument, and why do you think that doesn't matter so much?
This is what you see Ryan in particular pushing. I don't buy it. I think that voters may want to see action in a way, but I think suggesting that voters are sort of value neutral, they don't care what the action is, they don't care how it affects them, they just want to see things get done, doesn't make a great deal of sense. You know, we've seen do-nothing Congresses that have not really been punished. Republicans have not passed a whole ton of legislation recently, and they haven't been punished, although it's hard to think of an example where you had unified control of Congress and the White House and still got so little done. I'm sure voters would like to see things done, but they want to see things done that help them. And polling suggests that they understand who this bill is going to help out, and they're not jumping at it. The people who do think that something must get done, that, you know, they put their money in, they want to see something happen, are, again, the donors. But I don't think that's how most voters approach voting issues. They're not. It's not a checklist. It's not just the number of things that get done. It's what those things are.
You cited two national polls that had different results about how popular the plan is. What do you make of them?
Well, it's interesting. People do. I think there's a still remaining kind of enthusiasm for the idea of tax reform in the abstract. And so sometimes if people say, if you ask poll respondents, well, what do you think about the idea of tax reform, you will get more positive results. Sometimes you don't. And the spread is a little bit interesting. It's hard to tell quite why we're seeing, you know, 10 to 15 point differences in different polls. And I think it has to do with the way the questions are asked. But when you break it apart into the constituents' parts, what you find is people don't like the actual elements of the plans as they're written now. It's kind of the opposite of Obamacare, where you saw people were very unfavorable to the bill as a whole and to the law as a whole afterward. But if you ask them about the individual provisions, they tend to support them. Here we have the opposite going on.
Listeners, we can take your phone calls for David Graham from The Atlantic on the Roy Moore case, on the tax bill. We're going to get into Trump in Asia suggesting that he believes Putin's denials about meddling in the U.S. election more than he believes our own intelligence agencies, and then sort of kind of trying to walk it back. 212-433 9692. And Alex in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Alex, thanks so much for calling.
Oh, well, thank you for your fabulous show, which I never miss. My comment is about the Roy Moore case and the fact that very often in situations like this, the media seems to harp on the consistent comments over and over, the same thing. But they rarely provide enough of the other side. The comments that have been made and that I've read about why it took the girl 40 years to report it. I've only heard one television commentator bring up the reasons why someone at 14 might not bring it up. I, as a 14-year-old teenager, was approached by teachers inappropriately. I would never have told my immigrant parents. I would never have told my friends. Given the culture down there, one can easily understand why a child wouldn't say anything, why her parents might not. Then you're in high school. You become a target. And it could ruin your high school, your academic years. Then you go to college. Then you have a boyfriend. I mean, imagine the circus. If you whether you're believed or not, you become a pariah. There are so many reasons why a child may not report it and why they just let it go. And why is it coming out now? Well, the guy has been run out of office enough times. She may have thought, well, good, he's not doing anything of real consequence. Now he's going to be a senator. Now there are other women coming out, and people tend to believe them. She didn't seek out the Washington Post. The Washington Post found her out, I heard and read. So I guess there just doesn't seem to be enough counter-argument that makes logical sense for people that don't have children or it never happened to as to why it might not have been reported. Yeah. And I think that's important.
Thank you, Alex. The whoever's saying that the fact that she didn't come forward for 40 years is somehow makes her a disqualified accuser. I mean, they just haven't been paying attention to the whole history of understanding sexual assault allegations, and not to mention the power difference in this case. And so often in all the cases we've been hearing, Harvey Weinstein, journalists, the comedian Louis C.K., all of them, there's such a power differential. And in this case, this woman says that she didn't come forward previously, largely because she thought that Roy Moore, as powerful and as popular as he was in the state of Alabama, would be believed and her name would become mud. And that power differential is such a crucial factor. She did say, by the way, that she voted for Trump. She's voted for the last three Republican presidents. So that kind of halts any argument that she's doing this for partisan purposes. She's not involved with Moore's Democratic opponent in the Senate race. She wasn't involved politically with Moore's Republican opponent in the primary, so none of that stuff surfaced. And as you say, the Washington Post, because Roy Moore is a Senate candidate, started sniffing around in Alabama more than they sniffed around before, and they came up with these things and approached the women. They didn't approach the Post. So thank you for your call on that. I do want to get to this before we go back to some more phone calls. I do want to get to the Trump in Asia thing over the weekend, his tweet saying Putin genuinely believes Russia didn't meddle in our election, and our intelligence chiefs who said he did are political hacks. He tried to clean that up a little bit yesterday with this.
I believe that President Putin really feels, and he feels strongly, that he did not meddle in our election. What he believes is what he believes.
So he's saying what he believes is what he believes. Trump wasn't saying he believes him. He was saying Putin genuinely believes his own statements that Russia didn't meddle. And Trump tried to clean it up a little bit more with this.
I'm with our agencies, especially as currently constituted with their leadership. I believe in our intel agencies, our intelligence agencies. I've worked with them very strongly.
We'll do a separate segment on this later in the show, but that'll be with a CIA expert. But David, I guess he's now saying his CIA director, Pompeo, is not a hack, even though Pompeo concurs with the Obama and Bush era ones. What was Trump going for with all of this?
Beats me. You know, this is, we've seen this a couple times when he went on his trip to Europe over the summer. We had a sort of similar thing where he was asked about Russia and he said, well, I don't think they did it. And then it kind of reversed and he just muddies the water so much that it's very hard to tell what he's talking about. You know, I find his argument that he was simply saying that, that Putin really believes this confusing for a lot of reasons. One, how does he know what Putin really believes? And two, why would he tell us that? You know, what is the importance of that? Three, of course, no matter who the intelligence chiefs are, whether it's Mike Pompeo or anyone else, there remains widespread agreement among the U.S. intelligence agencies that this was Russian meddling. So the statement about what Putin really believes, I think, is a red herring, and I think this is all part of sort of muddying the waters. He does, remains reluctant to admit to any Russian meddling because he feels like it delegitimizes his victory.
And still incredible, and it really needs to be pointed out for bigger picture context, he gives Putin the benefit of the doubt until pressed more than he gives our own intelligence agencies over and over again all year.
Absolutely right.
Any political ramifications or Mueller investigation ramifications from this, or is this kind of thing already baked into whatever one already thinks of Trump?
I suspect in the immediate term it is largely baked in. Because he has muddied the water so many times on these things, you know, I'm not sure we're going to see a big shift. It does in the long term undermine his credibility. And as we see more and more evidence of Russian interference, and in particular of ways in which members of the Trump campaign were involved with Russia, whether that's George Papadopoulos or Carter Page in his testimony to the House a couple weeks ago, these denials just become less and less credible, and that eats away at his credibility, such as it already is.
Dora in Valley Stream, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dora.
Good morning, Brian. Thanks for your great show. Back to the Roy Moore issue, I think one thing that actually disturbs me more is the fact that Roy Moore used his position of authority to stalk his victims. From all accounts, he met his first victim, the 14-year-old, with her mother in the halls of the courthouse. And if a person wants to find a pattern, they should go back to see if while he was a DA or a district attorney, I believe at that point, if there were other young people, young women, whom he approached in the hallways. Then secondly, he also found his second or third victim as he was giving a civics lecture in her high school classroom. So it's very disturbing to me that many of these young people may have seen him as a mentor or an authority figure in addition to their parents,
yes,
similar to how many Catholic young people would have seen a priest as a person to turn to, trust, and therefore feel intimidated with reporting should they take inappropriate actions towards them. So
that's right. And in the case of Lee Korfman, the 14-year-old, the story that she told the Washington Post, as I guess you know, Dora, is in a way even worse in that her contact with Moore was, Moore was this assistant district attorney who was there at the courthouse while Lee's mother was going in for a custody hearing.
Exactly.
And Moore volunteered to watch Lee, the girl, so that she didn't have to go into the courtroom and hear ugly things in a custody hearing.
And was left, you know, with a man who had even more sinister ideations towards her. And it's striking to me that he stated that he would never date a girl without getting the mom's permission. Maybe in his mind, telling the mom that he'll watch her daughter was, in a way, in his twisted mind, getting permission. I just find the whole thing so much more sinister, given his role in society, in their society at that time, and that he may have used his position to stalk young people, and there may be more girls out there.
And one of the pieces of corroboration in the Washington Post story is that they looked at the records, and sure enough, Lee Korfman's mother was involved in a custody hearing at that courthouse in February 1979.
Exactly.
She said it was early 79, and that Moore's office was right there in that courthouse. Dora, thank you very much
for your
call. Molly in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Molly.
taxes. I was interested in knowing, you know, first of all, I thought they were going to have the vote already, and then do we know that they have the votes to pass it? Because I thought Corker was against it. It sounded like McCain was against it. And so I'm just wondering if they have the votes to go forward and pass it.
David, what do you know?
It's a little bit tough to tell at this point. It seems like they have the votes on the House side. Leadership is sort of projecting some confidence. We've seen them project confidence on Obamacare votes, too, and had that not pan out. So it's a little bit tough to tell. But it looks like the House is probably on a path toward passing its bill. The Senate is still working on markup for its bill, and so we don't know quite what the final version will look like. For example, they want to make the cuts permanent. To do that, it has to be revenue neutral, and they're not there yet. So
also,
first you've got these two... Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say there are some significant differences between the Senate bill and the House bill. As you know, like now the Senate bill, which has come second, does not repeal the estate tax. It makes the corporate tax cut deferred for a year. The House bill would have it take immediately, so it could be on people's tax returns next April. And the Senate bill also does not repeal the Obamacare mandate provision. So they're fairly different, right?
Right, exactly. So even if they can both pass their bills, then they're going to have to go to conference and get them on the same page. So there's a lot of room for things to fall apart, and there's just a lot of details to be hashed out before we really have a good sense of where the bill is going.
There's one little bit of breaking news. I don't know if you saw it. It's not earth-shattering, but you never know what ramifications an appointment has. And I'm seeing that while we were talking, the Trump administration announced that they are nominating a replacement for Tom Price as Secretary of Health and Human Services, and it's Alex Azar, however you say it, A-Z-A-R, who was a deputy HHS secretary in the George W. Bush administration. Is this someone you know at all?
His name came up a little bit last month in speculation. He was a Bush administration HHS figure. He was also, I believe, the CEO of Lilly and Company. So he's been around the orbit. He's widely respected as somebody who knows the business very well, and is a serious person. Beyond that, I don't know a whole ton about him. It's interesting that they announced this while Trump was in Asia. I'm curious why that would be.
Jay in Somerset County, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hi, Jay.
Hi, how are you? I just have a very interesting take on this, is that what is going on? What the heck is going on in this new America? Everything is up and down. Morality is in question. You know, whatever that we had thought of, let's say even 20 years ago with Gary Hart and monkey business thing, now we have our president grabbing women by whatever, you know, and we have this guy that we're questioning, you know, did the parents say yes or no and this and that? What is going on here? I mean, is anyone questioning this? Is the morality wrong? Are we in some Twilight Zone episode? And the other thing is that with everything that goes on Fox News, just imagine if we had a foreign network like, let's say, Al Jazeera, putting their spin on everything. Would the public accept, let's say, lies from a foreign network, like the lies that are spewing on Fox News? I mean, what is going on? If anyone can answer this, it's a rhetorical question, of course, but I am just beside myself. You know, I don't even know how to explain these things to my children. I make them watch news every evening, and I have no response to their questions because, like I said, everything that was up is down now. Morality is going sideways, and if anyone can answer this, I'd be happy to listen, you know, and go from there, I guess.
Thank you so much. Listeners, as we approach the end of this segment, feel free to tweet at Brian Lehrer and answer Jay's question about what's going on here with everything seeming to go morally topsy-turvy. And to his point, David, I will point out one other irony. The thing that got Roy Moore, one of the things that got Roy Moore suspended from his elected position as chief judge of the state of Alabama, was that he refused to enforce a Supreme Court order a judge who refused to abide by a U.S. Supreme Court order, and of course it was the order that gave the constitutional right of marriage to gays and lesbians. And so I guess for these vocal defenders of Judge Roy Moore, it is somehow more of a sin for two consenting people who are really adults to have a relationship than it was for Moore at 32 to have one with a teenager, or at 34, as one of the allegations are. And then there, at least one of them is willing to compare him to Joseph and Mary while denouncing gay marriage.
That's right. I mean, the other irony here is that the sort of questions about what is happening to our culture and sort of degradation of morals that the caller expressed are exactly the kind of plea that Roy Moore rose to prominence on. These sort of, you know, complaints that society was in moral degradation and everything was falling apart. And here he is, in fact, accused of being exactly some of the immoral behavior that he rose to prominence denouncing. It is really sort of an up-as-down situation.
Any political analysis of evangelicals in Alabama based on what we just said?
You know, it's hard to tell. I think what I would take away from the Trump experience is that evangelicals these days seem to be willing to vote for a candidate who has moral flaws, if they think he will defend the policies that they care most about. And that's exactly what we saw with Trump. There was, in fact, a remarkable shift in evangelical willingness to overlook personal flaws in candidates. And so I would expect we'll see the same thing in Alabama. What I'm interested to see is whether there's a shift among white female voters who might, you know, object to this behavior, or maybe they won't. And I suspect that could be pivotal in the final vote.
53% of white female voters went for Trump, even a month after the Access Hollywood tape last year. It'll be interesting to see if Moore stays in the race, how that particular demographic shakes out on Election Day, December 12th. So, folks, those of you who only think of The Atlantic as a glossy monthly magazine, you know, they're very active with daily politics on their site and on their app. And one of the lead writers for that practically every day is David Graham, who has been our first guest today. So, David, thanks a lot. We always appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Much more to come.